Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. It is 3 o'clock, and that means it is time for Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money. Now, my next guest, she is not herself a millionaire, but in honor of Labor Day, this week, Maggie and the Millionaires are going to be talking and focusing on being overworked and underpaid. The fact that we all, us middle-class folks, work very hard for our money in America, and we're maybe not quite getting ahead as we should. My guest is Dr. Caitlin Henderson. She has let me know that I can call her Katie, so I don't mean to take your degrees away. Dr. Caitlin Henderson, she's a senior researcher at Oxfam, which is the largest anti-poverty organization in the world. Dr. Henderson is the lead researcher and author of Oxfam's Best States to Work Index, which Brian and I will put in the show blurb from today so that you can all check it out, which looks at how states treat workers and working families in the U.S. Previously, Dr. Henderson was a Brent Scowcroft Award Fellow with the Aspen Strategy Group. So with all of that, welcome, Katie. Thanks so much for making time.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
This is so important. But before we jump in specifically to how Wisconsin is doing compared to other states, tell us about what the Best States to Work Index is, and how long have you been doing this report, and how does the index work? Like, what are the inputs? How do you rate these things?
Definitely. So our Best States to Work Index is a piece of research that looks at 27 different policies across three major themes, and those are wages, worker protections, and rights to organize. And we track these 27 policies across all 50 states, DC, and Puerto Rico, and we rank the states on how they perform, with the idea being we're really encouraging a race to the top of the index. And the index was really born in a moment when the federal government wasn't doing much to improve worker policies and help out low-wage workers and working families. So the idea was really, while the federal government isn't doing enough, let's take a look at what states are doing to really step into that gap. So we rank all the states on whether those policies do or don't exist, in order to really celebrate where progress is happening and try and encourage where progress can be made.
So why did you focus on these three categories? Again, just to refresh everybody's recollections, you're looking at wages, worker protections, and basically whether or not the right to organize in a labor union is protected under state law. How are you measuring those things? Why did you focus on those three items?
Definitely. Great question. So we've been doing this index for about 6 years, and the research really started when we did a huge scoping exercise of what are the policies that are most necessary and most important for workers in general, but especially those low-wage workers that maybe are not receiving benefits from their employer. So a lot of folks that have great jobs have great things like good wages and paid leave and all kinds of protections at work. And so what happens when workers are not guaranteed those from their employer? What happens when they rely on the state or the federal government to set that standard? So that's how we kind of created the list of the policies and really thinking, you know, what is the most important thing for workers? And there are some very obvious answers, like a minimum wage. Right. And you know, I think we all recognize the importance of paid leave, especially in this post-COVID moment, when having the ability to take a sick day was so critical. But also there's a lot of great information on the union difference. And so we really wanted to look as well at how states were supporting unionization, but not just unionization, also, you know, collectively bargaining for public sectors, and and really trying to get a holistic picture of what is most important for that low-wage worker and their families.
I know that you added a new category or specifically called out warehouse workers in this year's most recent report, which I found fascinating. Immediately my head went to, oh my gosh, of course we're talking about Amazon, right? And frankly, some of their now notorious, what I would call union busting tactics that they have deployed. And it also raised for me, I want to kind of ask you about this as one big, very broad category. I understand as a lawyer and someone that both was in a collectively bargained unit and then entered management and had unionized workers working with me. My understanding has been that the National Labor Relations Board has been effectively like defanged sort of in the post-Reagan era, right? And that their ability to really penalize companies like Amazon for union busting has been quite neutered, and they don't have as much power as they did, which speaks to the very need for the index in the first place and for states to step in. So all of that is a really big open-ended question for you, talking about warehouse workers.
Yeah, so let me take one quick step back just to say the really cool thing about this index is that it is a dynamic living piece of research. So we are able to add policies every year when we see sort of a changing landscape for workers. And one of those changing landscapes that we're really seeing is the increased use of technology in workplaces. And I think warehouses are one of the best examples of that, where we're hearing a lot more about the use of technology, not just to surveil workers and keep tabs on them, but to institute quota systems to mandate production. What's hard is that a lot of these quota systems are really unobtainable, and they're causing a huge influx, or increase rather, of injury in the workplace. And so one of the reasons that we included the warehouse worker protection policy to the index this year is we're seeing some states really pay attention to that and create new policies that are really setting the standard, not just for other states, but also for the federal government, of what can be done to support workers in what is a very dynamic and changing landscape for workers as we're moving into these new sort of hybrid environments where it's both technology and people supposed to be doing the work. So that's one of the nice things about this research, is that it can respond to a changing world. And then to your question about what does this mean and what do we think, what are we seeing when it comes to the National Labor Relations Board? You know, for folks who are unfamiliar, that is the entity that sort of oversees the ability for unions to form. When you want to create a new union, that's who you register with. It is a federal government entity. And you're right that there has been a weakening of the National Labor Relations Board for the last many years. It means it's harder to form a union. It's harder to sustain a union. And that's actually just looking at the federal level, right? And this piece of research, when we're zooming into the state level, we see for sure that, you know, National Labor Relations Board aside, where you have those right to work laws, it makes it even harder to get even the first step, which is to make a union. And what we're talking about here is, you know, the repercussions of if you're trying to stymie unionization is so important, but that's even step two, especially in those states that have the right to work law on the books.
So two questions, and I don't want to forget either of them. The first one was, I was wondering, Dr. Henderson, if you could describe how truly incredibly onerous some of these warehouse worker quotas are. I have seen some of the reporting on this, and I could not believe what was being asked of human beings. It was just, the quotas were basically, as you noted, unmeetable. And the mental stress as well, which then also contributes to more on-the-job injury. Can you give folks an idea that they might be able to understand how huge these quotas are that people are being asked to meet in Amazon warehouses?
Yeah, and you know, we're seeing, I think a lot of people reference Amazon as the big instigator of this. And I think that more than just Amazon warehouses are starting to use this policy, which is why we need to really think about it. But we have some great partners that are doing sort of the leading research on this. So I cannot take credit on the information that we do have about these types of quotas and the impact, but it's effectively the idea that you have to be on your feet for essentially 7-8 hours at a time at breakneck speeds, reaching and pivoting and moving and trying to fulfill tens to hundreds of boxes full of things. And it's a rate that is just not tenable. And it means that people are constantly injuring themselves, whether it is throwing their back out or being physically injured from a machine. You know, it's just really increasingly more and more dangerous. And it's so important to pay attention to, because we are very reliant on warehouses now to fulfill even our most basic needs. So many people completely shop online. And so we need to really pay attention.
Yeah, every box you get, somebody had to pick that product off a shelf and get it in the box. And again, the speeds that I've seen and some of the firsthand accounts of workers have just been shocking, in my opinion. Listen, my special guest this half hour for this Labor Day week, honoring workers in America, for Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money. She is not a millionaire, but her name is Dr. Caitlin Henderson, senior researcher at Oxfam. We got to take a little bit of a short step away to take care of some of our business, but we'll be right back with Dr. Katie, because I want to talk about these right to work laws, and then I want to find out, how's America doing? How's Wisconsin doing? Because I have a little sneaking suspicion that we ain't doing so well, because we've got one of those right to work laws as well as Act 10. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. We'll be back with more for Maggie and the Millionaires with Dr. Caitlin Henderson, senior researcher at Oxfam, the largest anti-poverty organization in the world.
Stumble to the kitchen, pour myself a cup of ambition, and yawn and stretch and try to come to life. Jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the streets, the traffic starts jumping with folks like me on the job from 9 to 5. Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living, barely getting by.
Welcome back, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. You are in the 3 o'clock hour, so it is time for Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money. My special guest this afternoon is Dr. Caitlin Henderson, a senior researcher at Oxfam, the largest anti-poverty organization in the world. She and Oxfam have just released their report for this year called the Best States to Work Index, which looks at how states treat workers and working families across the U.S. Before the break, Katie, we were talking about right-to-work laws, which I always think is a really interesting name for these pieces of legislation, because everybody's like, well, right to work. Yes, that sounds good. I support everybody's got a right to work. But what does this legislation actually do? It should basically be called the anti-union bill instead of the right-to-work bill. It'd be great if you could explain.
Yeah, absolutely. So a right to work law is effectively a law that makes it harder to form and maintain unions. It sort of takes the teeth out of unions a little bit. It takes money away. It means that you no longer can require dues from your members. It makes it harder to unionize. It makes it harder to collectively bargain together. And it means that a lot of the benefits of unionization is pulled out from under them a little bit. It makes it a little bit, just a little bit weaker to be part of a collective unit when you're going to the bargaining table and trying to negotiate for things like benefits or salaries or working hours or pensions or whatever the case may be.
Yeah, just some of the specifics for folks at home. If you've heard this, what it means is that each year, any existing union has to effectively recertify. In other words, the membership has to say, yes, we want to continue to have a union, and people have the option to opt out and not have any of their wages go to union dues. All of that sounds really interesting and maybe a little appealing, except that, of course, what you have the sort of inertia element of this, because it requires an affirmative action by workers every single year. We all are suffer from inertia. We generally will tend to take fewer actions when all else is equal, so it's less likely workers do that. And also, you then run into a fundamental collective action problem. All workers benefit from the union bargaining, but if you're opting out, you're effectively shirking or free riding on the union benefits that your union provides to all workers for the most part. We could get into some specifics on that, but just wanted to let people get a little bit of a baseline there. So let's jump in. How is America doing overall for working people and working families?
Frankly, it really depends on where you live. Mm-hmm. One of the big reasons we did this index is because the federal or national standards are so low, and some states are doing so much to make things better that now there's widening inequality totally based on the geography of where you live. And that can include neighboring states, which is really complicated. In this country, where you live shouldn't mean whether or not you get paid a fair wage or whether you're protected at work. But increasingly, that is the situation because there hasn't been movement at the federal level. I think Wisconsin is actually a really good example because Wisconsin neighbors two states that have much higher wages in Illinois and Minnesota. In both Illinois and Minnesota, there's paid leave. So you have the ability to have a paid sick day, not lose a paycheck if your child is sick. And in both Minnesota and Illinois, there's some stronger protections around the right to organize. So you can live 5 miles from the border of a different state and yet be paid significantly less and have significantly fewer protections. So as a country, we are really waiting for the federal government to step in and create a higher standard. But if you're living in Oregon or California, Washington State, DC, you're doing a lot better than some of your neighbors, which is honestly not super fair.
It's not super fair. It also, in Wisconsin, we hear from many of our business owners, Wisconsin's a great manufacturing hub of the United States. Businesses love to come here because our workers are skilled. We traditionally and reputationally work really hard and are incredibly productive. And yet you set up this sort of inequity and it will lead to brain drain or just worker drain. People will leave because they're not going to get the same level of wage and benefits as they would in some of our neighboring states. How is Wisconsin specifically doing on this best states to work index relative to some of our neighboring states and overall?
Yeah, so Wisconsin is ranked at 38 out of 52. So again, this is all 50 states, DC and Puerto Rico, if you're wondering where that 52 is coming from. So Wisconsin's in the lower half. And one of the big reasons for that is because a lot of Wisconsin's laws in regards to workers are reliant on the federal standard. Wisconsin has a minimum wage of $7.25, which is the federal standard. Wisconsin has no paid leave. Wisconsin doesn't extend many protections to workers that we consider federally excluded, like domestic workers. And Wisconsin is one of those right-to-work states that doesn't have many protections for unionization. I will say, and credit where credit is due, because I think it's important to identify where progress is needed, but celebrate where there is positive policies. Wisconsin steps up in a lot of ways for farm workers. And I think that's important to identify. Wisconsin is a great state when it comes to agriculture and farm working. And so there is some positive policies there. So we do see the potential for great policy change in Wisconsin, but there's still room to improve. You know, compared to some neighbors, Illinois is at number 7, Minnesota is at number 11. So it's wow. quite a difference. Yeah.
What is, we just have about 2 minutes left. What is the one or two policies that you think can really have the biggest impact for working people in the U.S.?
I think for all working people in the U.S. and Wisconsin as well, let's raise the wage. Let's raise the minimum wage. Let's get rid of the sub-minimum tipped wage, which yes. traps too many, especially women, in cyclical poverty. Let's get some paid leave so people who have care responsibilities in their communities can miss a day of work to care for someone but not lose a paycheck. And let's really protect the right to organize. We know the union difference. It increases wages. It increases protection at work. You are safer. You're less likely to be injured. You have more benefits. It does matter. So if I was going to say three things, it is raise the wage, pass some paid leave, and let's protect the right to organize.
Folks, that's Dr. Caitlin Henderson, senior research at Oxfam, the largest anti-poverty organization in the world. They just published Oxfam's annual Best States to Work Index. Folks, Brian and I will put that in the blurb for today's show so you can check it out with your own eyes, but you heard it here. Raise the minimum wage, paid leave, which is a big old fat duh, right? And protect workers' rights to organize. Thank you so much for making time for us, Katie. I can't wait to have you back again. Stay tuned. The Maggie Dawn Show continues here on the Civic Media Network after these three messages.
This ain't Texas.
Matt Rothschild here on the Maggie Dawn Show, subbing in for Maggie, and I'm here with Angela Lang from Block as my co-host. Love that song. I'm playing Texas Hold'em tonight.
I feel like you said that last time. You play it regularly, huh?
Every Tuesday and Thursday night.
Nice.
And I actually went down to Elgin and played on Sunday. My son and I played and won a little bit of money, so that's always nice.
Nice. Congrats.
There was a tournament of 116 people, and both of us got to the final table. So nice. That was sweet.
Impressive. Yeah. That's cool.
I don't know if you want to look at my sheet over the years, but it's taken a beating. But anyway, here we are. And if you were just listening to the last segment, that was just a little snippet of a conversation that Maggie Dawn had with Caitlin Henderson, a very impressive senior researcher at Oxfam America, who's the author of a report called The Best and Worst States to Work in the U.S. in 2024 in Wisconsin. Coming in at number 38. You can hear the whole full podcast, half-hour conversation that Maggie had with Caitlin Henderson on the Civic Media page under special segments. One of the things that's so shocking about the state of working people in Wisconsin compared to other places, is we still have that ridiculous, ludicrous $7.25
yeah.
minimum wage, which is... according to this report, I didn't realize it's the longest frozen minimum wage we've had in our country's history since the beginning of minimum wages. And it's just obviously not even close to anywhere near or half near a livable wage.
I mean, you can almost buy a latte.
Maybe.
That much. Almost.
Depending.
You can tip.
Yeah, no.
You can
I mean, you can't pay rent. You sure can't pay rent anywhere in Wisconsin,
$25
an hour.
But people don't need that, right? I mean,
of course not. Housing. It's just interesting because as we, you know, kind of still are in the shadow of Labor Day, I was lucky to be on with Greg Bach, filling in for Jay Matt Nair earlier. And we had Earl Ingram on, and he was talking about how he had a large family. I think he had like 11 or 13 or so children, siblings, like in his family, and they were able to have his mom stay at home, take care of the kids. And dad went out, had a good paying union job, and was able to support a large family on one income. And here we are. I remember when I first started organizing, talking about raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. And people thought that was ludicrous. And that was, you know, over 10 years ago. And if it would have kept up with an inflation, it would be at $20+. And it's just the fact that we have not even made an attempt as a state to raise the minimum wage, I think is shameful. And I think it's part of just the remnants and the remains of the Walker era as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's why we need these fair maps and need to get a Democratic legislature so that Evers and the Democrats can pass a increase to this ridiculous 725. We're, you know, again, in a minority of states here. A lot of states have increased the minimum wage, and we're lagging. We're like one of those southern states. I mean, Mississippi, people were joking about when Walker passed Act 10, but that's what we've become.
Yeah.
And union percentage has dropped by about 50% or 40% since Act 10. There's also something that I think should be illegal in this country, which is forced overtime.
Yeah.
It's true. You know, nurses are forced to work overtime sometimes, and forced overtime in other places too. I mean, that is not freedom.
Yeah.
I know Kamala Harris talks a lot about freedom, and she has that Beyonce song that is now an emblem of her campaign that she stole from Maggie Dawn, let's face it.
Lovingly borrowed.
Maggie should get royalties on that. Anyway, it's just not, you're not free if you're forced to work overtime against your will under penalty of being fired.
Yeah, and also depending on the industry, I was actually just having this conversation in the office today with our team. We were talking about nursing home shortages, and if there is a shortage in trying to pay people equitably and people don't want to go into that industry, there will be a nursing shortage or CNA shortage in our nursing homes. And so what, how that also plays into the level of care people get. So when people are talking about raising the minimum wage, it's not just so people can just live large, right? It's being able to be compensated so it draws people into that industry, and there's higher standards, and that trickles down to the level of care too.
And as that report noted, the best and worst states to work in the U.S., the care economy, people who work in the care economy, most often women, a disproportionate number of women in color, terribly underpaid in the care economy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, these, there's not a lot of benefits. And, you know, you're not getting paid vacation time. You're not getting 401k stuff. You're not getting anything a lot of times except your wage. And the wage is ridiculously low.
Yeah. And these are folks, like you said, that are doing really, you know, sometimes strenuous work, but also taking care of our loved ones too, or our kids, our families, our elders. And it's just so interesting what we prioritize as a state and as a country. The fact that teachers, even, for example, right, getting off a little bit on a tangent, they are literally molding our future minds of this country and have the success of this country in their hands. And we are paying them terribly. And it's just like the more responsibility you have, not only for our elders, but for, you know, our future generations, it's almost like the less we pay you and the less we value you under Republican administrations.
Yeah, if you want to join this conversation about labor and work in Wisconsin and why we lag behind so many other states and what needs to be done about it, give us a holler at 855-752-4842. The study we were referring to was from Oxfam, which I thought just used to do hunger reports.
Right, yeah.
But is now doing, and if I would wanted to ask Caitlin Henderson, the author, when they started doing this workplace stuff, but I'm glad they are. She's a senior researcher there who's been doing this study about the best and worst states in the U.S. for the last 5 or 6 years herself, which is an impressive feat. And she talked about not only wages, but working conditions and the right to organize. And of course, the right to organize here has been devastated since Act 10. And it wasn't just for public sector workers, as Peter Barker was reminding us in the previous hour, because, of course, Walker said, first, he was going to divide and conquer, and he divided public sector workers from public sector workers, excusing some people in police units and firefighters. And then he divided public sector workers from private sector workers.
Yep.
Notoriously said, don't talk to me about right to work when he was running for re-election. It's not going to be an issue. And of course, the second he got reelected, that bill landed on his desk and he signed it right away.
Yep.
I mean, he was such a ganef, as we say in Yiddish. He is such a fraud and a cheat, Scott Walker. Good riddance to him. I didn't like seeing his ugly face at the RNC.
In conclusion, Wisconsin being 38 on the list is due to Scott Walker, his cronies, and the Republican Party. If there's any question, right?
And he's still fronting for Trump. And, of course, there's Tommy Thompson, who's today in Milwaukee fronting for Trump.
Yeah.
I don't understand Tommy Thompson, how he can look at himself in the mirror at night or when he's brushing his teeth in the morning and have any dignity left, because he's got to know somewhere in there what dangers Donald Trump poses to us. And speaking of those dangers, Liz Cheney made it explicit yesterday at an event in North Carolina that she is not only anti-Trump, she is going to vote for Kamala Harris. We're going to run that brief little clip right now. Thanks, Jess.
Don't believe that we have the luxury of writing in candidates' names, particularly in swing states. And as a conservative, as someone who believes in and cares about the Constitution, I have thought deeply about this. And because of the danger that Donald Trump poses, not only am I not voting for Donald Trump, but I will be voting for Kamala Harris in this election.
There it is.
That's impressive to me. It really is. And I hope it'll make a difference. I'm waiting for others, too.
Yeah.
I'm waiting for her dad, who I hated and still hate and believe he should be
brought
before the International Criminal Court for countenancing torture and overseeing torture in Iraq.
There's many things that her dad has done awful, and we know that. But what always just got me was he shot a man in the face and, like, whoops.
And how did he not get charged with
that? What? Like, sorry, my bad.
Who gets away with that?
Yeah, like, you shot somebody in the face. Like, right. That's why. That was, again, not to minimize all of the other ridiculous, harmful, terrible, dangerous things that he has done. But that just one always just stood out to me as one thing I just did not understand.
It's an example of two systems of justice. That's for sure.
The privilege. In this essay, I will. Case study.
That is exhibit A. But yeah, where's the dad on this? Who are you voting for? And I keep saying George W. Bush, Laura Bush. Come on now.
Come out of the woodworks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The old established Republican Party.
Yeah.
That has been thrown overboard by Donald Trump. I know you recognize the threat to our democracy that this guy, Trump, poses. I mean, after all, George W. Bush at the Trump's inauguration speech said, this is some crazy, and then a word I can't say on radio.
I appreciate you censoring yourself. Otherwise, I have to do it, and it's a whole thing.
Oh, no, I saved
fines
you.
Fines are probably involved.
I saved your reflexes there, Jess, but... Yeah, I mean, I'm waiting for more decent Republicans, and I know there are a lot out there, and I'm sure there's some listening right now, who will go into the voting booth on November 5th, maybe secretly if, their partner doesn't agree with them, but not vote for Trump, but actually do what Liz Cheney is. I'm not only not going to vote for that guy because he's so awful, but actually because it's so important to the future of this country, I'm going to vote for Kamala Harris, even if I've been a Republican through and through. And we talked about my poker game. I know decent guys who identify as Republicans, but some of them I'm sure aren't going to go in there and vote for Donald Trump either, because they understand it too. And it's just important for more and more Republicans of stature. And that's why it angers me so much about Tommy Thompson. I'm hoping that maybe his daughters will come out and say, we're not with Dad on this one.
I think what's interesting and what really struck me by Liz Cheney is because you do see some Republicans that say, I cannot in good faith endorse or vote for this man. But they just stop shy of saying, I'm voting for Kamala Harris. Or, they're just like, I can't support that man. Or so it's like, are you writing in someone? Are you doing something else? But for her to just say it plainly, boldly, it's not, I'm not just not voting for him. I am actively voting for Kamala Harris as well. And I think that's not something you see all the time from folks very clearly distancing themselves from Trump for reasons and, you know, and rightfully so. But they still sometimes can't bring themselves to actually say the thing that they're going to be supporting openly, this first Black woman to be president. And but your vote when you go into that ballot booth, or if you are voting from home via absentee or early voting and all the different ways to vote, that's just between you. And so at the end of the day, you have to reconcile with that. You I know some folks that probably lied to their friends about how they voted. But at the end of the day, I think people really need to vote their conscience in whatever way that looks for them.
And that's why I like a lot of the work that the Lincoln Project's doing. And I admire Todd Alba on the Todd Alba Show for talking as a former Republican. I admire him for having Trygve Olson, who I disagree with on a lot of political issues. But Trygve Olson and the Lincoln Project stressing how important it is for Republicans like him, and he calls himself a Dobbs dad, a Republican with daughters who wants his daughters to have some freedom, and to acknowledge it. Yeah, I'm a Republican, but yeah, I'm voting for Kamala Harris.
Yeah. Going back to Tommy Thompson for a minute, we see that there is a comment from Jude from East Troy reminding us that Tommy Thompson's was nicknamed Toxic Tommy by some. So maybe that helps us make sense of why he moves the way he does. Because I mean, and that's the thing, it's like there are times that he has talked about some of the impacts of his own you know, policies and whatnot, and then you think that there could be hope, and then he just falls right back in line. And you know, I would hope that he would understand that Wisconsinites deserve better, and that is not indicative of our values.
Yeah, and part of it may be just a social thing, you know, what are my friends going to say who I hang out all the time? They're all Republicans, blah, blah, blah. You got to get over that.
I was going to say, we're too old to be mad about peer pressure with our friends at this point.
And he's older than the both of us.
Exactly, yeah, no.
And so at the end of the day, he's going to say, yeah, I helped Donald Trump win re-election, if God forbid he wins re-election. How shameful is that, Tommy Thompson?
Yeah.
We'll be right back. I'll take your comments about it. 855-752-4842. Matt Rothschild here, subbing in for Maggie Dawn on The Maggie Dawn Show, and I'm here with Angela Lang.
Take it to the flow now. Ooh. Hoops, Spurs, boots. To the flow now.
Hey, Matt Rothschild here on the Maggie Dawn Show. Last segment for the day. I'm joined by Angela Lang of Block. And we're going to be talking a little bit about the environment in this last section. If you want to join the conversation, 855-752-4842. Of course, you can call up and talk about Tommy Thompson or talk about Trump or talk about Liz Cheney, anything you want to talk about. But just yesterday, my wife and I went to Devil's Lake. First time we've been at Devil's Lake in a long time. And we had a great time. I was watching I'm a bird watcher. I was watching the osprey circling. I was watching the turkey vultures. I was listening to the cedar waxwings and just had a great time. It just reminded me what tremendous natural resources we have.
Yeah.
Really jewels we have in our state parks and county parks here in Wisconsin. And one of the biggest differences between, the Harris campaign and the Trump campaign is what they do for the environment. And Biden was talking about that in Westby earlier today, but it's really true. I mean, you know, Trump is still doing drill, baby, drill, which is horrifying.
Yeah.
And yet we have Harris here who's talking about preserving more of our public lands and protecting our national wildlife refuges and not selling them off to the oil and gas industry, which is what Trump would do. So anyway, I'm just wondering what your favorite state park or county park is, where you'd like to go.
Yeah. So I say this as a proud board member of the Milwaukee Parks Foundation. And understanding how access to green space or parks or, you know, clean drinking water and things like that all have an effect on our mental health, right? I went to Riverside University High School in Milwaukee on the east side, and right behind our school was Riverside Park, and we had our track and everything, but then there was also a path. We always called it like the woods. I don't know if it was called anything else, but you'd go off of the track and there's kind of a wooded area and there's a river, and it was very serene for me to go there in the mornings before class started and things like that. And you know, I also think about, I cheated on Wisconsin a little bit, but please don't hold it against me. I went to Chicago for my birthday last month and stayed at a friend's house. We love her. Thanks for hosting us. But she had access. There was like a beach right behind, and I swam in Lake Michigan.
How cold was it?
It was beautiful. Really? I stayed out there for hours. It was also a very hot weekend. It was kind of like 90s plus. But there wasn't any gunk on it. It didn't smell funky. I could see down. And it was the clearest I'd ever seen a different side of Lake Michigan. And I remember kind of looking around, kind of just floating and just kind of looking up. And I was like, is this what peace is? We need to protect this. And mm-hmm. everybody, no matter where you live or your zip code, should have access to our earth and our planet, and it needs to be protected for future generations.
Yeah, Devil's Lake was real clear yesterday. My son went swimming. Mm. I was too chicken, but he went in and had a good time out there. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of gunk in the lakes in Madison. I mean, the Madison lakes are kind of nasty right now, and we got to clean those up. But yeah, this difference on the environment between Biden and Harris.
Yeah.
Is about as dramatic. Well, a lot of issues are dramatic, but this is just another one.
I also think it comes down to like priorities and investments. And I think it just goes more and more on brand that people like Trump would rather sell out our national resources and our beautiful resources for a quick buck, right? The same way he always is in the interests of businesses and things like that. But now he's also trying to almost like profitize and privatize our most basic resources versus the Harris campaign wanting to actually protect that. So I think it's just another level of how this con man, businessman, basically is trying to capitalize and profit off of our most basic treasured resources instead of trying to protect and defend them.
And it's part of a real far-right ideology that we've been fed over the last couple of decades, that everything private is good everything public is bad. And we can't let them get away with that. I mean, we need to defend our public goods. We need to defend our community goods. And what are public goods or community goods? Public libraries, public parks. I mean, there's a lot out there that we, public lands, that we deserve to have kept in public hands. Horicon Wildlife Refuge, Wyalusing State Park. I mean, these are gems.
Yeah.
And to, you know, allow, you know, drilling or fracking around Wyalusing State Park is crazy.
Yep.
And selling off rights to some of these public properties is crazy too.
I think that there is something to be said about how people talk about public goods and the dog whistle behind it, right? Because when something is accessible to the public, including Black and brown folks, historically marginalized folks, low income folks, then it becomes a problem, right? People want to privatize whatever because they want to make it inaccessible to low income folks, and that they feel that they should have exclusive access and rights and privilege to a public good because they somehow think that they have made it in life. So they are the only ones that should have access to it. And those dirty, you know, kids that go to public school, how dare they, you know, how dare we share the same space, unfortunately. And I say that as a proud public Milwaukee Public Schools graduate, understanding how this divide on public goods is really kind of just like an extra dog whistle. Who goes to public schools? Who's able to attend some of these things? And I think it's a quiet dog whistle. You know, we've seen some dog whistles that are not bullhorns, but I think it's interesting how people talk about public goods, though.
Yeah, and we need to come back to the idea that we deserve these things.
Yeah.
Not we're entitled to these, like it's an entitlement that we're spoiled little brats, but we deserve great public schools. We deserve clean air, clean water, recreational places. I heard a study that said even 5 or 10 minutes a day in a park is so much better for your health than not going out there.
Does wonders for my mental health, I'll tell you that. Especially in years like this when there's so much, you know, craziness happening. Absolutely.
Yeah, we need those things to clear our air and get back to nature even briefly. And the places to do it. And in Wisconsin, we're lucky to have a lot of them.
Yeah.
And we'd have fewer and fewer under a Trump administration. Yet another reason why we've got to get Harris and Walz over the finish line here, and also a Democratic Congress and a Democratic legislature here in Wisconsin. So I want to thank you, Angela, for being with me today. Angela Lang of Block. I want to thank our guests, Peter Barca, Caitlin Henderson. Thank Maggie Dawn for letting me be behind the mic. I want to thank Jess in the booth for helping us out.
Hey, Jess.
It's been a lot of fun.
Welcome.
So have a nice day, and let's get it done on November 5th. Take care.